off the ball rugby.
It hasn't worked out well for Ireland, particularly, which were ultimately the paymasters. But then at the same time, Ireland weren't paying James Lowe's salary. Leinster were. He wasn't on a national contract.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Really busy show coming up between now and 10. Delighted to say Rachel is here with me. How are you, Rach?
Very good now, thanks, Will. How are you?
I'm all right. Andy Cole has been casting his mind over the papers and indeed Steve Clark's comments after the game as well. How are you, Andy?
I'm very well.
It won't take long to play Steve Clark's comments after the game.
No, it won't, because he is not a man to mince his words after a game, especially when he's a little bit pissed off. And pissed off he was after Scotland's 3-0 defeat to Brazil last night.
And how? What's your sort of initial thoughts on the 90 minutes as a whole?
We made it difficult for ourselves. That's it.
Up against top quality opposition like that, I suppose the frustration is they didn't have to work too hard for their goals.
We gave them the goals, we gave them the game they wanted. Disappointing.
Bit of a waiting game now. How do you look at what's to come?
I was waiting, I didn't even think about that. Sorry, I don't even think about that.
No worries, Steve, thank you.
Quite the contrast. So McGinn was interviewed first, that's the BBC interview with Steve Clark afterwards. And McGinn was kind of going, look, you know, our chances have obviously dropped, and he wouldn't have known that their chance have dropped even more with South Africa's win later on in the morning as well. But he was very accommodating with his interview. You know, kind of the BBC have taken the time to bring me over for a quick chat here in Miami. Steve Clark, you could tell, a bit like the Morocco game, didn't want to speak after the Morocco game either. But yeah, weird. And then his ITV interview as well ended. He kind of went, we're going home.
Yeah, that was so bizarre.
Hmm.
Are you?
No, they've even now.
You're not allowed yet.
According to the supercomputer that everyone's using for the predictions at the moment, they still have a 22% chance of qualifying, even though last night was a setback.
Oh, God. Whatever supercomputer I was looking at gave them a little bit more of a chance.
Yeah, they were on 40-odd before South Africa won.
43, yeah.
South Africa winning was bad for them.
Yeah, it was. Even if you're that pissed off after a game, though, like, you have to say something more. You know, you can feel it radiating off him, but after the Morocco game, he was the exact same. Like, you know, surely there's someone having a word with him in his ear, just going like, say more than three words, please, there. Yeah. Have you ever had that after a game where you've just been trying to eke a couple of words out of someone and you can tell, like, I feel so sorry for the presenter because, you know, no matter what you ask him, he's just going to give you a kind of stonewall three or four word answer.
I interviewed John Rahm at the Irish Open Golf in Ballyliffin when he had, I think it was his 3-wood he had broken about 2 holes before he finished his round. And European Tour media were obviously keen to get a guy who was, you know, up around world number one at the time and was the big star at the event, aside from Rory McIlroy. Let's get him across all the media. And you've got this, like, quite tall, imposing man that is John Rahm, who did not want to answer any questions whatsoever. And you're trying to stay positive. You know, John, you know, you're still going through to the weekend. And he was just giving one-word answers to everything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's uncomfortable to watch those scenarios, isn't it?
It's uncomfortable, yeah. It's uncomfortable to stand across from it. The only thing about Steve Clark is, though, like, there's a lot of Scottish fans obviously gone over to America. They had a wonderful time in Boston. I'm sure they've had a wonderful time in Miami, those who travelled down as well, and their brief drop-off in New York along the way. But the reality is that there's a lot of Scottish fans who couldn't make it across. Third major tournament they've gone to, you're kind of wondering, what was the setup tonight? Why were there no subs before the 80th minute? All kind of reasonable questions that you'd expect to hear answers to. And if Steve Clark basically turns around to the interviewer and goes, not having it, not talking.
Mm.
You want to know what's happening. You've stayed up to 1 o'clock in the morning to watch your team as well.
There definitely is an element of that. And I think the first thing that most people who work in broadcasting or journalism is to jump in the defense of the person doing the interview and thinking that Steve Clark is being a bit of a dick here. On the flip side of things, I can totally see myself in Steve Clark's position here. If I'm at the World Cup, I'm not here to take part. My team have capitulated in 2 games early on and let the opposition dominate them. I'm not sure I would want to talk too much after the game either. You know, it's an obligation. They have to do it. It's part of their job. It's part of their remit. They are obliged to do it because of FIFA. But I'd say how many managers, players would opt out of media obligations if they had the option?
Oh, especially when you lose. And like, it's ridiculously raw. And like, to your point, especially in these situations where they don't get a little bit of time to think about it before it happens, so it happens very quickly after the game is finished, there's two sides to that coin. On the one hand, I think you can get wonderfully raw, unfiltered comment that happens just after a game because they haven't had time to compose themselves. Mm. But on the other hand, it is uncomfortable if somebody is as annoyed as Steve Clarke has been and he doesn't get a chance to compose himself. But I just think it's one of those things, you suck it up as an international manager and you just kind of accept that you're speaking to the audience back home. It wasn't like the questions were particularly tricky either.
No, it is like watching late on stage Martin O'Neill for Ireland a bit with Steve Clarke. I mean, you mentioned the comparisons with Trapattoni there, but Steve Clarke is very much in late stage Martin O'Neill with Scotland. The fans don't particularly like the brand of football he plays. They generally feel like they would be more expansive. They can be more expansive and probably get better results. Steve Clarke doesn't feel that way. He has gotten results this way. He's doubling down. He's spiking with the media. So it is reminiscent of the Tony O'Donoghue interviews with Martin O'Neill at the end of his tenure at Ireland. So
you've just reminded me wonderfully. I was in Porky Queeve the day that Declan Rice declared for England. And I was the person who had to ask Martin O'Neill about the fact that Declan Rice had just declared. It happened about an hour before a press conference. It was the day of the Lee Miller testimonial.
Oh, yeah.
And Martin O'Neill was managing the Irish selection team. And understandably, it's going to come up at some point that, you know, we've all got push notifications literally before it started that Gareth Southgate has confirmed that Declan Rice has just declared. And Martin O'Neill had a spiky enough relationship, I think, with the Irish media about the fact that Rice had not been capped in a competitive game. And that would have been enough to entrap him, if you want to look at it that way, as an Irish international, as opposed to going back to playing for England. And I got both barrels from a very, very spiky Martin O'Neill that day. Tony and I actually had a good laugh about it afterwards because he was like, he didn't know if he was going to ask.
Yeah.
It just turned out that I had the three questions at the very start. So the
you
first
were just
thing
kind of trauma bonding by the end of the whole situation.
It was like whatever, the media officer was just like, well, off the ball. And you're like, all right, here we go.
Yeah, I volunteer as tribute here. I have to ask the question.
Yeah. And look, it's just one of those things. I think he had become very annoyed post Euro 2016 with the Irish media as well, particularly that kind of Nations League campaign that happened afterwards. It felt like a long goodbye.
Mm.
And the performances had turned a bit at that stage. And look, let's be fair, we all enjoyed Lille. We all partied. And I will always have a very mixed relationship when it comes to Martin O'Neill.
I didn't get to go to Lille.
Oh.
No, I actually joined off the ball.
Just after that?
Just after Lille. Oh. Just after everyone got back.
You missed all the fun.
Great crack. But with the Martin O'Neill thing, we probably will chat about it a little bit with Paul. Yeah, like because we're used to seeing Martin O'Neill for the last maybe 10 years now being this jovial sort of jokey character, because he is quite funny and he is self-deprecating and quick-witted. We saw it especially with Celtic last year because, you know, he was kind of in as this interim thing and it was this, but you do forget, like, he's a spiky guy.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve Clarke is also quite spiky. He's like, even when things are going great, Steve Clarke is not the best interviewee after a match. So given that it's a World Cup and you've just been trounced by Brazil, and I do think we were chatting about this outside, Brazil are up there with maybe Bayern Munich in the side you least want to get a trouncing off, because every time they score, they go and dance in the corner. And it's the same with the Bayern Munich. Every time they score, they play that music. And it just, I don't know how angry that would make you feel as a player on that pitch, watching those Brazil players samba dancing in the corner after going 3-0 up, and this is your biggest moment in potentially in your career.
We can talk to Paul about it, but the thing that seems strange to me was that part of the reason that Scotland have been successful in getting to the last three tournaments and the qualifying campaign they've just had is that they are very much safety first and they're a little bit conservative. And then last night, they were trying to play out like peak Barcelona against Brazil, who go at a really heavy press under Ancelotti. So it felt like, again, you give a goal away 4 or 5 minutes into the game. And I was watching the BBC coverage and McFadden's commentary is amazing, where he just basically goes, oh no. And at that moment, you kind of felt qualification is very much on the brink after what happened to Scotland early in the game. But like, I don't know, it seemed very strange because I thought they were almost too conservative in their approach against Haiti, where they needed to run up the scoreline. And then last night it was like, let's try and play out against this Brazil team and see what happens, and you see the result.
Yeah, it was for him to say that we're going home, for the Scottish fans at home and just for the Scottish team in general. Like, that's just bizarre. And obviously he's really pissed off, and he thinks that maybe even if they only like lose 1-0, he doesn't have that reaction, but they'd have a nervy couple of days waiting around. But that's not the atmosphere that you're going to want to be waiting around for if they do end up qualifying.
No. It's also such a bizarre, again, this is just part of the blow to the World Cup. And if you're a South Africa fan this morning, you're probably still partying after what happened at 4 a.m. when they won against South Korea and they qualify. And you've got teams like Cape Verde and Iran and Saudi Arabia who still have a chance of getting through to the last 32. But if you're in Scotland's situation, and it is a bit weird that you now sit there until Sunday to wait and see if they qualify. And I think I was reading, if it could potentially happen, that Scotland might have to play on Monday and still have to wait until the weekend to know if they're going to be one of the teams who are in the top third seeds.
Yeah, I suppose logistically that's not ideal in terms of preparation, also in terms of travel, depending on where the match is going to be. So it's just one of those weird conundrums with this 48-team tournament that it's not ideal and you don't really know what's going to happen. I do think it's the most Scotland of Scotland things to potentially not make it out of the group stages when it's almost harder not to get out of the group stages,
yeah.
Especially if you get a win on the board. Like Scotland have won a game at this World Cup and they still might not get through a group stage. When it seems like everybody else, like South Africa, one of the worst teams at this tournament, after their win last night, will potentially go through, probably more than likely ahead of Scotland.
They will, yeah. No, they're going to qualify. But like the other side of it is they're up against a team who are, I think, fifth in the world and seventh in the world in the group. Like it was a nasty draw to get both Morocco and Brazil in the same group. And even after the Haiti game, with a certain amount of celebration, oh, look, it's a Scottish win at the World Cup and they're going to, you know, finally, you know, eight World Cups of misery. They're going to get through this time. You're just thinking the reality is there's two very difficult games for them to try and navigate to actually qualify from that point. If you want to get in touch with the show, by the way, the WhatsApp is always open, 087-9180-180. You can comment us on the YouTube if you're watching live at the moment, or if you're listening along on your commute on OTB Sports Radio, you can always get in contact on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Off The Ball, or you can send us an email. I'm sure you check the emails at some point, Enda, do you?
I do, every day.
breakfast@offtheball.com. I always wonder about these, and I see the crappy quiz email and various different ones. Are they actually set up in such a way that they actually get read?
The breakfast one is only fresh, so it's not full yet. So we see them every day. We tend to use it for the breakfast buffet, Will.
Oh, it's
every Wednesday on Off The Ball Breakfast, which yesterday we spoke about the... You'll actually... I'm interested in two hurling heads in the studio now. We were talking about the ball, Joe Hart's comments about how he thinks the ball is moving differently, but we were talking about the chip and the technology inside the footballs and how you can measure like the impact. Mm-hmm. And Matthew threw out an idea that would work really well in hurling to measure hand passes for the hand pass rule. Or we could potentially get a shot tracker on screen for the broadcast if you had a chip inside a slitter.
A very good point. So the chip that's in the slitter at the moment, you know, the smart series that Pat Corgan still hates, which I think is really, I think he's really committed to that. Like if a year or two on, it's just kind of gone as normal and he's like, I don't want no microchip. I don't want any ball that's a luminous colour. I want it to be white, normal slitter. That's what I want to see.
Liam Rush was actually the same. I was chatting to him on Monday and we went through all like the serious rule changes, what he'd like to see, changes at the tackle, the head high tackle. And he was like, actually, you know what? No, it's the ball. Why is the ball yellow? He was like, it's not bloody Wimbledon. Bring back the white ball. He was like, no one's ever given me a good answer as to why the ball is yellow. He was like, bring it back. I want it white. And that was the hill that he will die on as well.
Bring us back to thicker rims. The rims at the moment are just way too small, which also helps the ball to fly the long distance it does. To Matthew's idea, and I think it is an interesting one about like tracking data on it. So the microchips that are in at the moment are just purely to check that they're actually an authorized slitter.
Yeah.
It doesn't give you any other detail beyond that. But I always thought there was probably a missed opportunity, as you said, that surely some data company could come in and work out how hard the ball has been hit. All these stats could have been used as part of the coverage.
Yeah, it's like the chips that are in dogs at the moment. Like, that's all. You just, you know, I used to always think that when you microchip a dog, if you lose the dog, you'll be able to find him again. But no, it's just that if you find a stray dog and you bring the dog to the vet, you can scan it and be like, oh, this dog has an owner. Don't know who they are. I can't find my dog.
The dog is not like Find My iPhone then, where you can just stick onto an app and check where
you have to put an AirTag on your dog, which is much more important.
Interesting.
But yeah, no.
Have you AirTagged your dog?
No, I trust my dog. All right, Sally. Yeah. Countryside living. Like, you know, we don't need a gate or a barrier.
The one hindrance to this, as we saw last week in Semple Stadium, where it took a long time for one of the Cork points to be disallowed, is that even at the moment we don't have Hawkeye in some of the best grounds. So like Porky Cueve is an incredible ground, Hawkeye, and the Hawkeye in Thurles, I have seen it in action. It is Windows XP.
Yeah, it's not great.
And basically you need a official to be there to watch the tracking of Hawkeye in Thurles. Everything is automated in Croke Park. But rightly, this is all very expensive technology. So
we see that is
Matthew's point. I love the idea, but on a practical level, rolling it out could be quite difficult.
That is where we kind of came to the conclusion of like the chips themselves are not that difficult or expensive to manufacture. That's a very, very cheap. But it's the technology that you need to make the chips worthwhile that is expensive. You need data company to analyze data. You need the computers to run them. So do you get that in a country ground somewhere in Carlow? Probably not. You know,
you best believe there's somebody in the GA, the marketing team, who'd be like, we can sell this.
Yeah,
we can sell it to the marketing team. And then when it goes to whether it be GA Plus or RT and they bring up a stat about how much the ball has moved or whatever has happened, it's brought to you by Harvey Norman, one of our own sponsors or wherever it might be. And it can be the Harvey Norman slitter check or something.
I'd love to see the stats of like the speed the ball is traveling when, especially probably Billy Nolan this year when he's making those saves like that. Insane.
There's that, and I was imagining something similar to like golf, where you can they track the drives. Like if you had that for a long puck or a point, like just to see the distance
the
of travel.
Of the ball.
Flight of the ball. As a broadcast, it would be amazing.
I'm not a Luddite. I'm all for this. Bring this tech in. Increase the coverage as best as we possibly can. Not against Matthew's idea at all. So does Matthew get a cut if this ever happens?
No, we all get a cut, yeah.
It's
a breakfast buffet, gets a cut. Yeah. Plenty of people in the comments point out that South Africa are second in the group, so they're already through. Yeah. I forgot that Korea...
That's bad news for Scotland, because they're points total.
Exactly, and Czechia are out.
Are gone.
Deservedly so.
Ireland's conquerors are very much gone. Beaten 3-0 by Mexico, and Okocha got to start, which I thought was the amazing part. So he's not been their first choice goalkeeper. This is his sixth finals, though. A bit like Cristiano, he's now played in six different ones. And it kind of felt like, is this a sentimental decision? Because Mexico were already through with their two wins. But yeah, they beat Czechia 3-0. And now we realise that Czechia possibly looked out a little bit in the nature of beating us and then beating Denmark. Czechia were really, really poor. Or the Czech Republic, whatever you want to call
desperately
it.
Desperately bad. We should, just before you get to the paper, we should also mention the Morocco-Haiti result. I know, it's the result itself.
What a mad game, but a game that I couldn't watch because this annoyed me last night because I was had the laptop. I said, right, I'm not going back out to the living room for this. I knew I was back up at 4:30 to come to Dublin for this show. So I said, right, I'm going to put the Scotland game on, but I'm going to assume that I can open another window in the RT player and watch it. And so I went to the RT player's dedicated World Cup channel, assuming that's where I would be able to see a bit of Morocco and Haiti. Particularly when Haiti went 2-1 up. You know, they were ahead, and I hope Morocco scores, and everybody's going to hammer them. That was 2-2. I went, right, I'll have a quick look. They were showing England and Ghana again from last night on the stream, which makes no sense whatsoever. Now, Des Kern, who was on the main commentary, was making the point, and he was saying, well, look, I've heard rumours of a goal in the other game. And I'm like, how in 2026 are we hearing rumours of another goal? Surely this should be picture in picture, and you should be saying, hey, if you guys aren't interested in Brazil 2, Scotland 0, you might want to see Morocco 3, Haiti 2.
Can I interest you in a knit-all draw that happened 2 days ago?
Bizarre. Absolutely bizarre. I couldn't believe it. I refreshed it and kind of went, is something gone wrong? No. The channel, and again, I believe they were having a few issues at the weekend, and this is not me having a pop at RT, but like what happened obviously on Sunday, where they went to say, oh, you can go to the player and watch the Cork vs Offaly game. And it didn't happen because the Irish language commentary was still continuing of Dublin and Donegal. I'd say they're just stretched. And I'd say probably last night there was just nobody to flick over the stream or something.
Well, yeah, that's part of the problem. But the result itself, obviously Morocco go on to win the game, which is grand. But Haiti's first two ever goals at the World Cup are two goals that they're the two of the greatest goals you'll ever score at a World Cup. And they were the first two they've ever scored. They were incredible finishes. The first one, such a deft little touch, and it's cheeky. And for that to be your first ever World Cup goal is amazing. And then Isidore somehow trumps it by blasting it into the far top corner to give them a 2-1 lead. Like, Haiti have been one of the most poor sides, I would say, over the course of the tournament so far. But, I mean, those two goals are fantastic, and that is their World Cup. That's a success for them.
If you're going to go out, throw a shot at the end.
Yeah, you'd rather be Haiti today, not qualifying, but having scored those goals, than Scotland qualifying for the final 32 with that loss to Brazil. Like, you know, I'd rather go out in a blaze of an unbelievable goal and say, right, you know, hats off, then qualify, probably lose in the next knockout round, having had like a really poor group stage as well.
I didn't give Haiti much chance of scoring, having watched the Scotland-Haiti game a couple of Fridays ago, where again Scotland looked really nervy. Going to put that down to, you know, first game at this World Cup and so on. But Haiti didn't look good that night. And obviously difficult to then say, right, you're going to have to try and beat Brazil and Morocco to qualify from here. But, you know, you're going to give both barrels to Morocco. Fair play to them. I was going to bring, I'll bring up the Joe Cannon comments in a moment, but Flanagan, say it ain't so, is what I'm going to say to this, because the Irish Times have got a pull-out section today, and Seamus Flanagan on media yesterday, naturally does quite a bit of punditry at the moment. I think I've seen more of Seamus Flanagan in the last 2 months than my own family, so he's usually here, he's GA+, he was on the Sunday Game, I believe he's doing BBC for the semi-finals coming up in 2 weeks' time as well. But maybe his punditry career is going to be shorter than we thought, because Seamus Flanagan says he's not giving up hope on a Limerick return. So the five-time All-Ireland winner, obviously not part of the panel this year, said he made peace with the fact that John Kiely sat down, had a chat with him and said, look, I don't need you for this season. But Flanagan says, if he got the call, Rich, should he go back in?
Yeah, I was so surprised that he wasn't involved in the panel this year. Like he's what, is he 28 only?
Yeah, he's definitely only late 20s, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, it's been our gain because
right,
his analysis and like his insight into just like the setup of Limerick, which has been so hush hush, like, you know, nothing is getting out of there, and famously so. And I know he's not even giving out trade secrets or anything, but his insight into like their setup has been outstanding. So I'd still love for him maybe to go back, but we'll definitely be losing an unbelievable pundit. And that'll be a hard team to crack into now. Say they go on to win the All-Ireland this year with those young guns. Imagine trying to crack on. So I'd say he's hoping to have a very impressive club campaign. Like what do you think he'd need to do?
Well, he played centre half back for his club last year because he's with us at Electric Picnic, and we were kind of saying, okay, what's this crack? Were you playing at six? And he was there going, well Declan Hannan is going to be dropping off the panel, so maybe Kylie can redeploy me at six. That didn't quite happen. He was saying that somewhat tongue in cheek at the time, but yeah, obviously wants to play in a reasonably central role there as opposed to playing in the forward, so maybe he could be redeployed somewhere else. I think, Andy, you're already texting Kylie and Kinnark saying, not a chance.
Yeah, don't bother.
I have him booked every Tuesday for the summer. So.
Yeah, he's put on a few pounds since he was in the panel last. Don't bother.
I really enjoyed his the video of his Gaelic football goal when he was talking to Tommy the other morning as well.
Yeah, it was incredible. The
panache
is like we're talking about like levels. Like the fact that Seamus was a brilliant hurler, is a brilliant hurler, and just the schooling that he got when he came up against actual good Gaelic footballers was funny to hear about. Thought he was very interesting as well. You mentioned the insights into the Limerick dressing room, what he was saying about Jim McGuinness and being surprised that he hadn't prepared for every scenario in the sense of like training and being able to use the breaks that you have versus what Kylie would have done. Like it's, I suppose it goes without saying that the best prepared teams tend to do the best work, and for John Kiely, he was leaving nothing to chance. It wasn't just that we're not going to get knocked out. It was like, well, no, what happens if we do? And we have an option there for training. Tom Brady was actually speaking about Bill Belichick in that way as well. And I thought it was very interesting on Stick to Football. He was saying that he thinks that the teams with the best players tend to do fine, but the teams with the best preparation are the teams that go far, or teams that can build sustained success. So he was saying, you need the players, absolutely, it's a big thing, but what you also need is the best prep, and you can't have one without the other. So he was kind of saying that Bill Belichick, the reason he was successful wasn't because he was the best coach, it was because he was the best prepared coach. And he had really good players to back it up then at the end, whereas, you know, I'm not so sure Donegal were fully prepared this year for what happened.
Yeah, Caroline Curd is probably exhibit A of that example, isn't she? You know, that Limerick had the players when she wasn't there and still couldn't get over the line, and seems to be whenever she's involved with that magic touch and that extra bit of preparedness that I suppose this year will tell all.
So the one thing that I really like about Caroline Curd, right, no matter what team she gets involved in, and in recent times she's been with like Mike Cullen in Galway and now back with Limerick, you talk to players, right? You try and find out what she does. They will not tell you.
No, I want to know. I want to know what she does. And it's like, it's always so aloof. And I know Declan Hannan has spoken about it before, but it's just,
in the most general terms.
Yeah,
possible.
It's like, oh, she's great. You know, she really brings out the best in you. It's like, how? Tell us. What's she doing? What kind of witchcraft is Caroline Curry doing?
So Kinnark told me a few months ago, when I was down at Declan Hannan's retirement gig in Limerick, I asked him about, like, you know, what does Caroline bring back to the panel? Because she was only just literally gone back in with them at that point. And he was saying that she's kind of almost like a release valve for the panel. So when they get into a situation whereby there's loads of media or loads of talk about, are Limerick going to win the All-Ireland and Limerick about Clare in the semi-final, she's available for more general conversations with the players, but also one-on-one sessions if they want to talk about their performance or maybe concerns that they have. And apparently a lot of the conversations, I think Flanagan has said this as well, not giving a huge amount away here, that if they do have issues off the pitch, they can kind of go and talk to Carolyn about that. It's about kind of getting that performance out, but also getting them into the right mindset. And I know some people probably think that this is all a bit kind of wishy-washy and whatever, but clearly Carolyn has got this incredible track record across various sports, various different teams. There has to be something in it.
Oh, absolutely. And even hearing him speak about how it was Kylie's and the management's problem, or, you know, it was up to them to deal with absolutely everything off the pitch, and they literally just had to show up and train. And then when they weren't training, they were completely switching off from hurling. Because you'd imagine as an inter-county hurler these days, or an inter-county footballer, that you're constantly thinking about training, your nutrition, your sleep, everything. But it seemed like they were obviously on top of all of that stuff. But as soon as they were kind of off the pitch, they weren't engaging with hurling.
Yeah. The reason it sounds wishy-washy is because it is largely wishy-washy.
I think there probably are a few snake oil salesmen out there.
Totally. It's hard to know what works and what doesn't. I remember speaking to Niall Moyna years ago about high performance and recovery sessions and ice baths and saunas and bits and pieces like that, and trying to pick apart and understand what works, what doesn't, what is pseudoscience, what's not pseudoscience. And essentially his point of view was, if it works for a player, then it works. There is not one method that is better than the other. Like he says, obviously, like getting blood flow into your muscles, things like that, that clearly scientifically works. But ice baths, if it works for the player and they think it works, then it works. And it's quite similar with sports psychology, is that if it works for one player, then it works for him. Just because it doesn't work for another player does not discount that it does work for another player. So it really is just the kind of the cliche of, like, you get what you put into it. Like, if you buy into it and you think that it's working, that breeds confidence in the methods, and then the methods seem like they're successful. So suppose, like, one player could come out and say, it's a load of bollocks. Another player could come out and say, well, she actually transformed my season or my career. So,
yeah,
like, that's sort of why it falls into that wishy-washy element of,
I think you made a very important point in there, whereby it's not one size fits all. And also, I would say it probably is determined largely by how much the player brings into the session as well, as much as anything else. You bring coaching in for anything, whether it be corporate, whether it be sport, or whatever. If they go in with an open mind and they really, really want to engage with that, and they come out with something, that energy they put in is probably energy they're going to back out. I think if a player turns up and goes, sports psychologist, this is all nonsense, in all likelihood, they're not going to get something.
Yeah, I mean, there was a famous story from Jim McGuinness's first tenure. He actually had it in his book where, I'm not actually sure it actually happened, but he had it in his book, because I've spoken to a couple of Donegal players from that panel, and they were like, I don't remember that. But Jim McGuinness had it in his book where one of his first sessions, he got all the Donegal players into a circle and he got them to hold their breath for either 70 seconds or 90 seconds. And, or was it shouting? Sorry, he got them to shout as loud as they could for 60 seconds. And, you know, as you imagine, someone starts to tail off after a while. And his grandiose point about this was that if you were willing to stop there after 40 seconds, are you going to stop for me after 40 minutes in a match? Kind of thing. And, like, those are the types of things that if the players buy into that and they're like, wow, that was such a powerful message, you're just like, really powerful, and you can harness that. But if one person thinks this is a little bollocks,
yeah,
it completely discounts the idea behind it. So it is that thing. You need to buy into the ideas that the people are bringing to you. If people don't buy into Karen Curd, if they don't open themselves up to it, it's not going to work for them.
Yeah. I think it's one of those things as well, that if she has that track record, you're going to give her, I think, your attention, and you're going to believe that she's right. I never thought I'd see this, by the way. So I'm just looking through some of the Irish papers. Understandably, New Jersey's is pretty much across the board. England takes a lot of the covers in the English back pages today. But Dubs must find Blue Way, obviously a bit of a pun on the New Way. And this is John Small, who was also doing media as part of that Electric Ireland event yesterday. And basically, he has called for a massive overhaul of Dublin underage football. which hasn't been bearing that much fruit in recent times. You know, they've watched other teams in Leinster particularly walk up and win underage success, and it's not that long ago that we felt it would never come to an end, the success that Dublin had at senior level, particularly provincial and all the All-Irelands they won. I mean, John Small's a seven-time All-Ireland winner himself, but he feels they need to now look at the structures that they've got underage football in Dublin to try and get themselves back up to the top.
Yeah, it's we probably had this conversation during the week as well with hurling and the whole Leinster-Munster debate and Leinster underage teams and Munster underage teams. But sometimes if a team like Dublin has been so successful and they go through a bit of a drought, like, is it a problem with the underage structures, or is it just that you had such an unbelievably successful team for so long and there's going to be a natural lull? I mean, they won an unbelievable game at the weekend and they're in with a very good chance of winning the quarterfinal this weekend. I mean, if they go all the way,
if they knock out Galway, they're a live contender to win Sam.
Yeah, then is there a big need to overhaul the underage structures? I don't know. It's like Mick was saying during the power rankings, you know, we can kind of revert to worst case scenario sometimes and the senior team isn't going well and we're like, yeah, right, goal game's up, we need to make a huge change. But and he mentioned like former players and everything's being involved, but like, do they have that with the under 20? Was it the under 20 setup that
Johnny Cooper
and them? Yeah, so like, it's, they've got good people involved. So unless they're talking about really changing how it's run and like taking a look at more people, like I know that's been a bit of a bone sometimes that there's so many good footballers in Dublin. How do you know you're getting a good look at all of them? And it's probably something we've seen with the Dublin hurlers and Nilo Kialikon, because he's so embedded in the club scene that he was able to bring really strong club players in and he had that knowledge. So unless it's something that you need to cast the net a little bit wider, but
yeah, I think Jerry Brennan will have a really good handle on that, especially given his day job. So in UCD he's been watching a lot of the top Dublin players coming through there, and obviously the aforementioned Neil Moyne is part of his backroom team and he's been watching them going through DCU. So you've got both sides of the city where they're very familiar with the very elite who are coming through at a very young level within Dublin, quite aside from the club. And yeah, look, it's one of those things. I mean, I was listening to Paddy Andrews on the football pod talking about this, and he was just making the point about Kieran Kilkenny, and he was saying that Kilkenny, I think in the 2011-2012 season, made his debut. And then you very quickly realise that's 14 years ago now at this stage that he's been playing for the senior team. So there's a lot of guys who are probably in that last spell with the Dublin team now, and it's just going to be interesting to see who the next players are to come through. It's clear that they've come back to the pack a little bit, but I think sometimes we overestimate how far Dublin have come back purely because of the heights they had reached before.
Yeah.
And like, I don't think it's going to be that long before they're back up towards the top of the mountain. And look, if they'd held on for a few more minutes against Westmeath, they would have won the Leinster this year, and it's going to be a very different conversation that we would be having at the moment. It's kind of weird that we're a couple of days on and there's still talk about Harry Kane and the Witch Doctor. You know, like, the abduction thing didn't happen with the aliens last night. I've got a feeling, Enda, that the Witch Doctor actually didn't have any practical impact on the fact that Harry Kane scooped the ball over the bar.
I don't know. I mean, you don't know. Matthew outside is very he's very scared of this conversation. He doesn't like us bringing it up. He gives him the heebie-jeebies. He did say now that the curse is lifted.
Right. Okay.
So he only wanted it against Ghana. He didn't really care going forward. So
that's fair enough.
We don't know.
I mean, I think you have to be limited in your powers on that. You can't overuse the powers of actually witch-doctoring people. Presumably it just won't work then at that point. Yeah, I don't know. The England thing is kind of strange. Again, you talk about overreactions. We've got to the point again whereby everyone has now overreacted to the fact that England have drawn a game. The first game all went very well. And now you've got Michael Owen saying, you know, England have got the talent, back them. You know, one frustrating night's not going to change that. But yet I see a lot of the things in the paper are, if things go wrong here, it's a bad sign for the rest of the tournament. And if England don't top the group, it could affect their seeding for the rest of the tournament. And yada, yada, yada. I think they're going to be absolutely fine. We'll be talking to Noel McNamara a little bit later on related to that. But there's a lot of people being asked about the Leinster job at the moment. Mick Dawson, on Off the Ball last night as well, made some interesting comments, the former CEO. He said, Ronan O'Gara going to Leinster would be like Brian Clough going to Leeds. So basically said, that ain't happening. Their fans are not going to accept the Munster legend turning up. But Jake White, former South Africa World Cup winner, was doing media yesterday as well. And he also said Leinster are the Barcelona of rugby. And he wasn't ruling out the possibility of him becoming the head coach in 2027. Very playfully in the Mail today as well, they've got a picture underneath all that talk in Shane McGrath's piece of O'Gara standing beside Leo Cullen. So I think everyone is determined to try and manifest at least this idea that Ronald Garrett could be next in. Mick Dawson as well, I would strongly recommend having a listen back if you're a subscriber, of course, offtheball.com/join if you want to become a member. If you want to listen back to that 20 minute or so conversation, he also responded to Brian O'Driscoll's comments from the show on Tuesday night, where Brian had said he'd been contacted by a prominent businessman who was also a Leinster supporter, who was willing to top up James Lowe's salary in order to bring it up to the previously agreed contract to keep him in the country. And Mick Dawson said, he's speaking now very much as a former CEO, but he said, I would have accepted that, try and keep James Lowe in the country. And he was kind of surprised that Leinster didn't do the deal. But he was very quick to point out he's been out of the position for about 3 years now, and he was speaking just as Mick Dawson, the man, as opposed to anyone involved with Leinster. What's Jurgen Klopp, even been saying?
So Jurgen Klopp, a lot has been made about the hydration breaks at this World Cup. I think it was especially jarring in the England game, where we had a 3.5 minute break of an injury, and then straight after that we had a 2.5 minute break for hydration. But Jurgen Klopp, surprisingly, is actually not he's not against the idea of hydration breaks.
It's really hot. It's good for the players. Is it good for the coaches? I would love it. Maybe it's a little bit too much right now. It's definitely too long, because for drinking you don't need 2.5 minutes or whatever. Like, and that's the thing. And it's got used. When you're in the stadium, well, it's okay. So because you get a little bit of a show in Dallas about the cheerleader, which I enjoyed on the big screen, it's like completely fine. But I understand when you sit at home and then the commercial starts. But come in my age, it's a welcome break to go to the toilet.
He's dead right.
2 minutes?
He's dead right. You can run out to the toilet or make a cup of tea. It is a hydration break for us as well. Also a fan of the Dallas Cowgirls, I think they're called, the cheerleaders. Don't know if you've seen the documentary about them on Netflix.
Which is a new series out right now.
There is. That's pretty interesting. The cutthroat nature of cheerleading. By God.
It doesn't seem like fun. That was one of the things my takeaways from watching a bit the first season. Was that I kind of, it was sent to me by a friend who went, you should watch this. This isn't kind of as cookie cutter as it might seem. And like, it seemed even at school's level, like as in high school level, it was, you got to come to a certain standard, and if you don't, you're going to be cut and your coaches are going to be really tough on you.
Oh, so wild. I only watched the first season as well, but like, probably the most toxic culture you can imagine, you know, lining up and just these kind of like classic 50-year-old American women with the jagged hair just being like, too fat, you know. Yeah, your kick isn't going high enough. It's it's like proper America's Next Top Model from like the early 2010s or even like 2000s.
And you get these amazing cutaways where you might have them talking one-to-one with a person. And you're like, Chantel, you're doing amazing. And then they do like they cut to them talking, yeah, she's not going to make it. She's too fat.
Yeah, and like, so brutal. It's awful, but the fact that most of them were just doing it as well for like pride of the jersey, like they were working full-time jobs or like going to college full-time and then just doing this. But I think off the back of the first season, they got a massive pay raise, which was, it was a great thing that came out of it. If you're a fan of the Dallas Cowgirls documentary, Cheer on Netflix, another documentary, that was class. They are freak athletes. Those people, like, they're just being hurled into the air, and the injuries they go through are insane. Again, not paid gigs, a lot of them just like colleges competing against each other, like Olympian level gymnastics nearly.
That's kind of mad that they're not getting paid for that, when you consider that like it's very much used as part of the entertainment all around the idea of the American football games at college level. And when you look at the crowds that go in and are paying to go in, for that not to have some kind of kickback to these, like, essentially athletes.
Yeah, they were getting paid, I think, but crazily low.
Yeah, they get scandalously low wages.
Yeah, but there was a shift in it after that first season anyway, which is good.
Okay. Right, so definitely, as Enda says, check out season two. The other thing I noticed, Enda, about this is that Jurgen Klopp, automatically, since he stopped managing, looks about 25 years younger.
It always happens.
Like, legitimately. Like, Klopp was getting a little bit grey. I know he's had the teeth done, he's had the hair, you know, resodded and all that along the way. You know, he's done the work. But what I noticed is that he just looks happier. Alexis McAllister was giving him his jersey the other night after the Argentina game. So Thomas Muller and Jurgen Klopp were on the pitch, and Alexis kind of made his way over. And funny enough, brought Messi over to give Klopp a little hug as well, as they were kind of doing their little lap with the fans. McAllister gave him the jersey, and I just was watching with Klopp, and he just looked so happy. And then I saw pictures of him having his lunch up in the gantry as well. And he just seems a very, very happy guy. Obviously, working for Red Bull as a consultant seems to be a bit easier than being the Liverpool man.
Yeah, well, like a lot of people want him back into management. And he's kind of like, nah, I'm done. I'm getting much more sleep. Mm-hmm. I'm enjoying myself more. I'm getting more sun. Getting to play sports more. Getting to go on holiday more. I've made my money. I've secured my legacy. What do you want me to do? Why would I come back?
How long does that last, though? You know,
well, Mark,
how long does like having a pina colada at noon over watching the World Cup when it's going to set into the winter months and
yeah.
he's getting a little bit
so
bored?
Hold on. He's got the winter sun. So Mark Lawrenson gave us the insight in this the day the Klopp decided he was leaving Liverpool. Yeah, so Laura lives down the road.
They've got a house in the same place, don't they?
They basically live like 5 minutes away from each other. And apparently Klopp's house, with some of the work he's done the last year or two, and basically Klopp's wife went out a little bit before they decided to retire to Mallorca, was doing a lot of work on the house. And Laura says it's the best house in Mallorca.
There's only so much time you can spend in a house, though. I'd love to see how long he'd get out of that when he's used to... When you're used to something that high pitch and that high energy, yeah, he looks great. He looks well rested and probably needed, but surely that kind of starts to scratch a little bit of an itch after a couple of months of doing nothing.
Mm. Maybe. I mean, I'd be okay being in Mallorca. Like, this is one of the good things about the heat over the last few days. We don't get it often enough here. And you're thinking, do you know what? That's actually just a standard spring day in Mallorca to be in the high 20s. I could certainly live by a pool with a pina colada and be absolutely fine with it.
He could do a Martin O'Neill on and come back when he's 75.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about O'Neill a little bit now in a few minutes as well. But is it possible, because I obviously saw the reports overnight, that particularly he's very annoyed about Sean Maloney in particular. So mm-hmm. Maloney was part of his management team last year. Maloney's contract, it would appear, will not be renewed by Celtic, or at least that's the feeling at the moment, that he won't be kept around for the coming season. And the talk is that O'Neill could genuinely walk over this.
Yeah, the journalist Craig Spears is reporting this, and when it's coming from him, it's coming
They're
from Martin
close,
O'Neill because they, yeah, so essentially he would have organised a lot of O'Neill's media tours. So like if O'Neill was doing like a night with Martin O'Neill, it was hosted by Spears.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was very, very close. So if it, and generally when he says something, it means that Martin O'Neill has said this to him and is okay with him publishing it. So essentially what he's saying is that Martin O'Neill is very, very close to pulling out of the Celtic deal if they don't get this Sean Maloney and Mark Fotheringham deal over the line. What seems to be the issue is that they were offered deals substantially lower than they were on last year.
So hold on, why would Celtic try and undercut them by offering less?
Because we're talking about Celtic Football Club here and they do nothing easy. I don't know if the question is with... Look, there could be several aspects of this. Maybe they were on higher wages than they normally would be because it was a short-term thing and they were interim and they had to get it done and they were willing to pay over the odds for it. That is an option. There is the other scenario where now Sean Maloney and Mark Fotheringham are double winning coaches.
Mm-hmm.
So they have higher leverage. So maybe they're asking for a lot more than they were on or a lot more than would be reasonable. That is... also giving Celtic some credit. There is also the option that maybe Celtic are just trying to drag this out a little bit to try save a little bit of money. But you have to think that if Martin O'Neill is the one that they want, and these are the two coaches that he wants,
and is central to his plan,
why not just give them what they want? But there is also this element of the Martin O'Neill, Sean Maloney stuff is that they didn't particularly get along too well last year when they were in an interim basis. Like, Sean Maloney wanted to play one way, Martin O'Neill wanted to play another. Martin O'Neill was the head guy at the club, but Maloney and Fotheringham were doing all the coaching. So you had this weird scenario where the team were caught in no man's land because Martin O'Neill wanted to play like more direct, but mm-hmm. Martin O'Neill football, and Sean Maloney wanted to play something a little bit more similar to Brendan Rodgers, which is what the players have been used to and have been speaking about, like, this is how we know how to play.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, it seemed like Sean Maloney won that argument because they started playing a little bit more like Brendan Rodgers football, and that's when the results started to turn in their favour. So the question is, like, is this even the right decision for the club? Like, why not go out and get someone else if this is the biggest issue? But if he feels strongly enough that he's willing to walk, then you just pay them what they want.
I know. And like, what an embarrassing climb down it would be if Celtic were to get to a position where they hitched their wagon to O'Neill when other people were being linked to it, and then within a few weeks O'Neill is gone.
Yeah, and it also doesn't help that the idea that you're treating a person like Martin O'Neill like this, who is already a legend at the club,
who came in to save
and came in to save you twice last season, won the double last season, and then in his very first summer as a permanent boss, your first stumbling block is the coaches that he wants to bring in.
Mm.
That does not bode well for a relationship between the coach and the board. So
I know we're going to talk about Scotland in a sec, but I do wonder as well whether this is an indication of where Celtic are going for the rest of the summer. So if they want to drag out contract negotiations with two key coaches that are part of Martin O'Neill's backroom team and they want to save a few quid there, would that indicate that they're really going to try and save a few quid and everything else?
Exactly. And they also said that they were going to back Martin O'Neill and Sean Maloney in the transfer window in January to help them get over the line. They brought in four loanees.
Mm.
So they have already done that in terms of not backing them. So like if I was Martin O'Neill, I would have absolutely no confidence that I'm going to be backed by the Celtic board. So